Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, October 14th. I'm Ray Graff. It's time for our monthly edition of the Vox Pop Science Forum today, and we have a great panel of experts ready to answer your questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If you have a science question of any stripe, you can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. The Science Forum is back. Your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We reconvene the Science Forum today. The experts are champing at the proverbial bit to answer your questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You may also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. 2551. If you have anything at all on your mind, science related, these people may or may not be able to answer the question. Let's have our team of scientists sign in, please.
Hello, it's Barbara Brabetz. I am a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Roger Giaboni. I'm an electrical engineer, and I have a company called Rogers High Fidelity.
Hello.
In North Adams, Massachusetts.
That's beautiful North Adams.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist. I used to work at the GE Research Center, but I've been retired for 7 years.
Oh, that is so great. You're just hanging out, relaxing?
Well, as relaxed as anybody can be in this day and age.
Yeah. A year and a half of that was a pandemic. So
yeah. Well, all right. Well, you sit home, you read the high and lowest, whatever, you know, and have a good time.
Well, I've gainfully employed a little bit of the time.
Oh, that's good. Me
but,
too.
But the other, you know, walking the dog, that
gotta love it
all takes time.
And then there's one more scientist.
Oh, yes. I'm Ed Stander, SUNY Cobleskill, geology, astronomy, environmental science, and anything that Barbara can't answer.
All right, before we get going here, and we have several emails already to start with, and then we'll hit the phones. Once again, the number is 800-348-2551. It's obligatory I ask the professors how things are going at Cobleskill.
Terrific.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah, we're just about at midterm. And
already?
Yeah.
Wow.
It happens.
The students are just starting to wake up. It's superb.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so the snow will fly and the grades will fall, and that's kind of what happens.
No, is that what happens when the weather's bad? People stay home?
Well, they get stressed out and work piles up, and it piles up faster than they think it's going to happen. I mean, those are gross generalizations, but that tends to be the trend.
Well, I mean, Cobleskill's a fairly tropical climate, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Yeah, we shear our sheep right into January.
Hey, Roger Giaboni, is that chair giving you grief over there?
No, we're fine.
Okay.
I'm just sitting way up
I
here.
I think that, okay. Oh, you can't get it back down.
It's all right.
All right,
it's fine.
Man. Okay, fair enough. All right, these emails came in. This one came in last night. This is from Susan. And Susan sent a couple of screenshots, and I passed it around to our scientists. She says, which of these screenshots is correct? Is UVA constant from sunup to sundown, or does it hang pretty close to UVB, which is minimal at the ends of the day and super high at noon? And what does the UV index mean if UVA is constant from sunup to sundown? As in the first graph, the UV index would totally make sense if UVA follows the same path as UVB. I have no idea what I just said. Jim Pickett, take it from here.
Okay. The one which is most correct in terms of the intensity is the one with the nice smooth curves that look kind of like a normal distribution with the UVB curve inside of the UVA.
All right, time out. Just quickly, for those who don't know, including me, the UVA means what?
The UVA are wavelengths that are shorter than the blue light, more energetic.
This is ultraviolet A and ultraviolet B?
Ultraviolet A and ultraviolet B.
Okay.
And the cutoff distinguishing those, it depends some on the source, but around 315 to 320 nanometers.
Okay.
What distinguishes them is the UVB causes reddening of the skin, the kind of the surface reddening sunburn. It's also the UV that's strongly absorbed by ozone in the stratosphere. So the reason these curves look the way they do in the screenshot is that when the sun is low in the sky, it passes through, it has to travel through the ozone layer in a longer path, right? Because it's going obliquely through the atmosphere. So more of the UVB is absorbed. So that one with the curves shows the intensity. Okay. The other one, what that's really kind of showing is the proportion of the UVA and UVB in the sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
So the UVA is a relatively constant proportion of the sunlight. So that doesn't change much during the day. I mean, the intensity does because there's lower intensity in the morning and in the evening. The UVB, its proportion is highest when the sun's more directly overhead.
All right. Well, Susan, thank you for that. That was...
more than you wanted to know.
Well, yeah? a great deal.
It's the same theory as to why sunsets tend to be red and the sky is blue.
Yes.
Because the longer wavelengths get through on the lower sun angles, and the shorter wavelengths come through when the sky's, you know, clear and at a high angle.
All right, that makes sense to me. Now, this is from Lee in Cohoes, and Lee is taking, oh boy, one of our panelists. I won't say his name, but he does many things very well. And he made a comment at the end of a show several months ago about menstrual cycles syncing up. And Lee in Cohoes writes, my concern is a statement made 2 months ago that indicated that cohabitating women's menstrual cycles somehow sync. Since that idea was first scientifically presented in 1999, other studies have refuted it. But the myth lives on, possibly because people like your esteemed guests repeat it. Well, who's a biologist here?
I think I've been pointed at.
All right. Oh, you're the
pointed at
you're
on the
biologist.
Radio.
What do you think?
So the anecdotes are that women who cohabit, that there tends to be an alpha female and that her menstrual cycle tends to offset the other menstrual cycles until they come into some kind of sync. And so this was the McClintock effect that was first reported before 1999.
It was a great movie with John Wayne.
I was like, what does John Wayne have to do with it? Yeah, he didn't know anything about this. So,
Not so sure.
Yeah, right. So it has been investigated. And first they looked biologically to say, is there a pheromone that the alpha female is putting out that is the trigger or signal to be able to sync the other women? They couldn't find a pheromone in particular. So they said, well, maybe it's not pheromone. Maybe it's visual cues or behaviors. Who knows? Because we don't always have to sync our behavior based upon what other people say to us, right? We can take the stink eye and understand it's the stink eye. And we can react accordingly.
Right.
Anyway, there were a few studies where they took college populations, because they're a great putting non-related females together in a space of the same age. And then asked them a series of questions about their housemates, and then they monitored the ovulation cycles of these individuals and found that it refuted that anecdotal evidence.
Okay.
So this has been tested time and time again, because we still have the anecdotal evidence that in certain households this does seem to happen. And it's hard to, you know, if you think about a menstruating female, she's menstruating roughly a quarter of the time. Right. So the odds of multiple women in that same quarter of a month menstruating at the same time, the odds get pretty slim if you go out three or four people in a household. So that's why the anecdotal keeps on coming back.
Interesting.
We can't find the cues, and the statistics don't bear it out. I don't think the door has shut on this, but I don't think we have all the answers.
OK, fair enough. This email from Paul in Johnstown. And Paul writes, this morning I listened to a fairly long roundtable discussion of renewable energy, mainly wind, solar, and tidal, as ways to attack our energy problems. A few months ago, I heard that Bill Gates is supporting nuclear power that utilizes sodium in the reactor with a claimed great reduction in radioactive nuclear waste. Would you kindly discuss this type of reactor, pros and cons?
It just uses liquid sodium as a coolant rather than water. You know, is that a more efficient transfer of heat? I don't know.
It supposedly is, yes. Okay. But the problem is, if it catches on fire, you're in trouble.
Yeah. In fact, a sodium reactor was built in Michigan, as I recall, quite a long time ago. And I don't think it's operational anymore.
No, I don't think it lived. I don't live is a tough word. I don't think it was operational for very long before they turned it off and said that this isn't a good idea.
Why would Bill Gates, who is he's rich, therefore he's probably smart, why would he say something like that then?
Because he's not building spaceships like the other rich guys, so he's doing this.
Okay, fair enough. And then Paul goes on. More recently, I read of a small but significant advancement in research on a fusion rather than fission reactor. Please also comment on this research. That research has been going on a long time, too.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Fusion's always 35, 50 years away.
Yeah.
I think what he may be referring to was some technology on magnets of being able to get very high field magnets.
Without being really, really cold? Or are they...
The problem with fusion reaction is containing the reaction.
Yeah.
Because there's so much energy, it gets so hot. To contain it, we don't have physical materials that do a good job of containing it. So the latest theory is to use what's called a magnetic bottle. It's basically a very strong magnetic field that keeps everything.
How strong of a magnetic field?
Princeton's got a research facility.
Yeah.
Don't they?
There's a lot of facilities, I think, that do this. It really had to do with the magnet design that something panned out. And
so this is not a superconductivity issue?
No, it's there probably are superconducting magnets, but it had to do with the design of the magnet.
Interesting.
I don't remember the exact details, but it's not like that was the breakthrough that will lead to a fusion reactor.
And that's hot fusion, of course.
Yeah, listen, don't bring up
cold fusion, which is a whole other story.
What, Ed, you're always throwing a grenade into the program, and now if you say chemtrails, it's off to the races.
I did not say chemtrails.
Oh, said now that. You said it.
You know what? Let's take a break and forget the last 12 seconds ever happened. 800-348-2551 is the number. Science Forum, we kid, of course. Call about whatever you want, and we'll do our best. Fox Pop, it's the Science Forum. Ray Graff with you, joined today by Barbara Brabets, Roger Jaboney, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett. If you have a science question, give us a call, 800-348-2551. Email us if you wish, voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll get back to the email bag in a little while. Jim in Simsbury, Connecticut. Jim, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question has to do with getting fat, I guess, on account of I'm one of those people.
All right, I'll take this one.
If a mammal eats this enough to handle its metabolism for the day, and then eats enough for, say, an additional pound in that same day, like 3,500 calories, I think, what is the process by which the weight loss or the weight gain happens? And how long does it take? Do you gain the pound that day, or does it take a week, or how does that work?
I love this question, Jim.
It is such a simple question and a very complicated answer. So given the fact I cannot use visual aids, and I'll do my best at trying to simplify the answer. So a pound in of food has way more than has less than a pound gained, if you will, because you're going to excrete some. There's also some losses of energy in the breakdown of the food, right? We require energy to actually break down our food to then absorb it. But we have a net understanding of, okay, 2,000 calories in will get us about what we need for the day. We don't actually burn 2,000 calories in a day, but the process of breaking down our food burns some of that calories, and then whatever's left over is what we need for the day. If you eat protein, for example, and do not have carbohydrates to go with it, because you kind of need the two of them together to run the metabolic process of breakdown, then you won't really do well to absorb the energy from that protein. So you won't store the calories, if you will, from that protein unless you have carbs to accompany it. So a lot of these low-carb diets, either fat-based or protein-based, you know, kind of your South Beach or your Atkins, work on the principles that if you limit the amount of carbs that you take in, then you're going to have to go harvest them somewhere else from your liver mainly, which stores it as glycogen, in order to process that as a fuel. And if you don't get enough of that energy because it's inefficient because you haven't gotten the carbohydrates along with it as a chaser, then it'll say, screw this. I'm not going to do this. I'm just going to go to the butt and take some fat and burn that because it's easier. So that's kind of how the weight loss happens. So your question about weight gain, there are hormones that run us. They're not all of, you know, estrogen hormones, but there are hormones that run our body to say, okay, store more energy. You know, we're going to be in a time of plenty. Don't store as much energy. And there's a lot of research into figuring out the leptins and the other associated hormones and enzymes that help us control that. Because you can imagine a weight loss or a weight gain drug where you could promote a hormone one way or another and then be able to lose weight or gain weight willingly. I mean, obesity is a real problem in the United States. And, you know, I myself would love to lose weight, but it's not, you got to eat every day, right? Yeah. It's not like alcohol where you can just say, okay, I'm never going to drink again. It's just not that way.
Can you do that?
We'd never say that.
I don't know.
Never say that. Not in this room, apparently. So we're going to be fat and drunk.
All right. Well, hey Jim, you want to follow up?
Yeah. Was that a little too complicated, Jim?
No, that was fine. But how about the second part of my question, which is assuming there's enough additional food energy and of the right types, do you gain the weight in a day, or does it take a week, or how fast does that metabolic change that adds to the body mass happen?
Right. It's a couple days. But of course, it's within your body through that time. Right. So if your scale is not going to really show it as stored energy, it's just going to show it as weight. Right. Whether it's weight as digestive fiber that's going to come out the back end or whether it's going to end up as poundage somewhere, you're not going to really see a change on the scale per se. But to actually store, it's going to take a couple days.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot. In my limited grasp of what you just said, Barbara, does that mean the old statement, I got a slow metabolism, can be true?
It can be true. Sure, it can. I think people wish it to be true more than it is true. But, it can be true. And, you know, thyroid, people who have thyroid disorders, low thyroids, they see weight gain when they eat almost no calories because their body is kind of in conservation mode. And it's going to slow down other processes in order to maintain its body weight or gain body weight.
The number here on the Science Forum is 800-348-2551. Roger Jaboni, Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, and Jim Pickett make up the panel. And Bill in Livingston, you're on. Bill.
Oh, hi there. On a previous program, I heard that mammals, particularly humans, are protected from fungal diseases by high body temperature. So my question is, what protects reptiles, amphibians, or are they more susceptible to fungal diseases, especially when they hibernate, when they can't get out in the sun? Or do they have some special system to protect themselves from fungal diseases?
Well, I can take part of that. Size of the animal really counts as far as that's concerned. A good example is what's been going on in the Northeast these days with the bats, where the bats are they try to hibernate. They hibernate in a group as a hibernaculum because they need to keep warm. But as a result, they develop a fungal. If one of them develops a fungal attack called white nose syndrome, it can spread throughout the entire colony. And because they don't have a lot of energy in that they're hibernating, it can wind up wiping out the entire colony over the period of time. So I don't think that answers your question. I think Barbara's going to answer that question for you. But that just happened.
This is a very Barbara-centric program.
Oh,
it is.
And they're all hard ones. Okay, Bill. I don't recall the question originally when it came to Science Forum. So I can tell you this about reptiles and amphibians, for example. Because they're ectotherms, which means they're quote-unquote cold-blooded, they're very dependent upon their environment for their temperature. They have a really, really slow immune system. So if they get ill, it takes them a long time to recover, and oftentimes they can't without intervention.
Uh-huh.
So if you've watched any of the zoo shows, they have these tortoises that are like 150 years old. And if they get a cut on their leg, it'll take them like a year to fix it. So with a fungal infection, you can think of it as you've got, you know, a slow metabolic process in the ectotherm in your reptile. You've also got a slower fungal spread because the fungus can't really incubate at those temperatures. And it's which one's going to beat it out, right? That's going to show you success biologically. So if the reptile can, its immune system can overcome the fungus faster than the fungus can grow, there's probably a temperature at hibernation where that's the case. The fungus can't really get a tread and the reptile will win. But if it's slightly warm, or maybe it's spring or fall and it's warm-ish for the reptile, maybe the fungus then can really take off.
Hmm. Bill.
A lot of maybes in
Thank
that,
you.
Bill.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Ed Stander, Roger Ciboney, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett. Lou is in Pittsfield. Lou.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
You
and
bet.
I've got a question about creating electricity. Most of the time when we're creating electricity, we're burning something to create heat to make electricity, right?
Yeah.
You mean like industrially?
So.
Yeah.
Yes. So why don't we use volcanic vents for
we do.
An unlimited supply?
Well, that's really the theory behind geothermal
energy. On a large
energy.
Scale.
Yeah.
Right, but with geothermal, aren't you using the surface temperature of 52 degrees and then a heat pump?
That depends on where you're talking about. If you're talking about a place like Iceland or Yellowstone where the ground temperature goes up very, very quickly because of magma underneath, places like that are using the geothermal vents, effectively the heat produced by the earth, to boil water and then run turbines.
Hmm.
So in those kind of environments, you can do it, and it's not a major problem. But you have to be in the proper environment to allow that to happen.
Yeah, there's quite
Don't
a bit. There's quite a bit of that in California.
Yeah.
So, aren't there a lot of places on the planet where you can get pretty close? I mean, there are even caves I've heard of that you can get really close to the center of the earth.
Well, no, you can't get very close to the center of the earth, but
well,
there
we're
are
still maybe not close to the center of the earth, but to where the temperatures are quite high.
Well, 7 miles down, the temperature of the earth is about 140 degrees.
Mm.
So you'd have to go a long way down before you got to temperatures that you're talking about. The big thing is that areas that do allow geothermal vents to be used are also usually very geologically active. And if you're not careful, you put a pipe down and the pipes break. This is one of the things that's happening, for example, in Iceland, which makes it very difficult to keep the thing operating. So they spend a lot of money putting these pipes down to make electricity, and then they break after a couple months.
All right, Lou, thanks for the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. The number is 800-348-2551. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll get back to the email bag in a few minutes. Frederick is in Albany. Frederick.
Wow. How you doing? I kind of heard you talking about metabolism for your body.
Yeah.
And you said something about a low thyroid, too, with people. I have, supposedly that's what I have, the low thyroid. But the thing is, I have to get up in the middle of the night to have something to eat because I can't sleep because I'm hungry. Is that... You know, I don't know what doctor I should be seeing, or you know, I just, you know, with this thyroid, it seems to be, you know, kind of messing up, and I'm losing weight actually.
Well, the for a physician who deals with a thyroid condition, you would want an endocrinologist. So you would ask your primary care provider to use an endocrinologist. There are other syndromes that can happen that are secondary to the thyroid problem that could be your issue, but I am not a medical doctor, so I'd hesitate to go through any.
Are you talking hypo or hyperthyroidism?
I'm low. I'm hypo.
Okay, hypo.
That's what they keep saying, but I requested an endocrinologist, and I got nowhere with them.
Oh, boy.
It's just like they gave me another different type of levetiroxin, but it's not that. It's actually to medicate the T3 instead of the T4 that goes to the T3. So that didn't work for me either. So I just can't seem to find the right, you know,
gotcha.
Doctor and an endocrinologist that would work together and, you know,
sorry
like
about that.
But like I said, middle of the night, the last 4 or 5 nights, I had to get up every night at about 3:30 and have something to eat because I can't sleep.
I'm sorry, man. Hey, listen, you know, from time to time, we will have an endocrinologist on Medical Monday. This is not that show, but we'll let you know when we're having that. And Frederick, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. This is the Science Forum. It's Stephen and Gant. Stephen and Gantsford. You're on. The minute Zach the engineer gets up from his desk, this happens. You all right over there, Stephen?
I'm all right, although I'm going through an area that's notorious for dead zones, so I'm going to pull over.
All right. Well, the engineer is going to make me a dead zone if we don't clear this up.
So aside from my question I wanted to ask in response to what was just being asked about losing weight, getting up at night to eat, I am a physician, and you got to wonder whether or not there could be an underlying malignancy or perhaps hyperadrenal state that is increasing his metabolic demands. But in any case, the production of energy currently is addressing issues of how can we get more wind energy, how can we get more solar, and various other pollution-free methods. But they're all focusing on huge installations, 16 gigawatt windmills, large solar central arrays, and how to route that and distribute it. They're going behind me. My question is, what's the drawback, if any, to distributed energy? That is, instead of putting all this money into huge projects, putting it into enforcing or allowing or facilitating people getting solar on their roofs. Everybody.
The issue is, people
in apartments and that sort of thing won't have that option. But
okay, Roger.
The issue is storage. That's the problem, is storage of the energy. Can we get enough square area on roofs to generate enough solar power with the low efficiency of solar panels? We might be. I don't know.
I think he's talking about feeding the grid, though.
No, he is talking about feeding the grid, but the problem is...
But look, with the amount of money you're putting into these huge projects, I sense that it probably wouldn't cost that much more to gradually start installing panels on everybody and putting battery storage in their basements.
Yeah, well, batteries are not a good storage solution. That's the problem. They're getting better, but they're not an ideal and storage solution. And let's not forget, every one of these processes we're talking about are energy conversions. We're not creating energy. They're all energy conversions. And every time you convert energy, you lose some of it. So it becomes less and less efficient. And, that's the challenge. Storage is the challenge.
Kind of on the question about distributed solar on rooftops, that's a question I've had as well. And I think the way that it works out is that the solar on rooftops suffers kind of from the retail problem.
Interesting.
A lot of the cost is just in selling the solar. The large solar installations end up being more efficient in terms of they acquire the land or get leased to the land. They can install a whole bunch of panels on an industrial scale and be done with it. Whereas the rooftop is certainly feasible. You get the area for free, but it's more expensive to sell, to finance, and install per kilowatt than it is
Every basement has an inverter. It becomes all the cabling that goes from those cells to the inverter. It's all sources of loss. I mean, it becomes challenging.
There's a lot of rooftops with solar on it. It's just that for an investor, they would put money into a large field solar installation rather than financing a bunch of little rooftop ones.
It's effectively easier for the government to support large installations than small installations. So a lot of it has to do just with the fact that it's expediency.
Yeah.
There's also one more piece, guys, and I know we've been on this question a while, but there's a redundancy of having mega projects or larger projects and that you've got multiple sources that can feed the grid. If I have a solar panel on my roof and we have a snowstorm that puts 30 inches of snow on my roof and I'm 80 and I can't go up there and take the snow off my roof, I'm out of electricity in 4 days. And then what? So then I still need a grid to feed me. So then you've got So if you're going to do a distributed network, it needs to have enough redundancy within each distribution cell to be able to cover those periods where your alternative energy is not going to work. Yeah.
So for me, my electricity averaged over the year comes from a community solar project in Johnstown.
Yeah. Are you saving money?
You're supposed to save a little bit of money, but I'm not in it for that, and I really haven't kept track.
Jim Pickett is here. Also, Barbara Brabets, Roger Jaboney, and Ed Stander. It's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the number. And we'll check the email bag at voxpop@wamc.org in just a moment. It's Vox Pop. It's the Science Forum. Barbara Brabets, Roger Jaboney, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett make up the science panel. They're answering your questions today at 800-348-2551. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And Barbara writes, I was asked recently by a child why the moon changes shape phases. This is such a basic question, but I actually had trouble answering him. Can you give me a simple way to explain this to a child?
What we do at Cobleskill is we hang a globe up on the ceiling and then put a light on it and then walk around it.
Huh.
And it makes it the easiest way to see what's going on. But basically, the globe of the moon is half in shadow and half in light. And depending on which way you look at it, that's what you see. So it makes it very easy. Just a flashlight and a globe hanging down and walk around it.
Yeah. Yep. Anybody else?
Okay. I love it.
This email from Jeff in Troy. Please explain the behavior of earthworms that seems to me to be suicidal, where they crawl out onto a hard surface, such as a pavement or a rock, and proceed to bake in the sun to the point of dehydration and death. And that is from Jeff.
They're drowning underneath the water. It's usually during rain, so they have spiracles. They have little holes on their sides that they get oxygen. And when they get clogged with water, they're effectively drowning. And unable to breathe. So they come out of the ground in order to grab that oxygen. And of course, if they're not smart enough to know when the all clear is sounded and they can go back in the ground, they're going to roast.
It's one of the problems with being an animal where both ends look the same. You don't know whether you're coming or going.
This is from Jules. And Jules writes, in regard to the Fusion Advance, what the other email was probably referring to, says Jules, is a significant increase in energy release achieved at the National Ignition Facility at Lawrence Livermore Labs. The ignition facility explores nuclear fusion using laser-driven inertial confinement. Not up to unity yet, but a significant increase.
Yeah, that I've read about that one, too. They got one that produced a lot more energy out than previous.
Yeah.
Now, we're just discussing here during a break. One of the problems is when they say they're getting close to break even, they're diddling with the numbers a bit. They're taking account of the energy that's actually going into that little capsule and not all the energy losses along the way with those hunkin' big lasers. They're also measuring the energy out as total energy, not energy that you could turn into electricity.
So it's a shell game is what you're saying.
Basically. So when they say, we've achieved break even, what they really mean is maybe 10%.
Yeah, I say that every paycheck.
Yeah.
I've achieved great break even. This is from John. Is the melting of the polar ice cap starting to affect the Gulf Stream? Is the effect beginning to be noticed? And that's from John.
That is to some extent open to debate, simply because most of the water that's coming, that's melting at the ice caps that they're talking about is in Greenland, and it's on the Johannesburg Greenland side. So the water coming in goes down the Labrador Current and then into the ocean.
The way it always has, by the way.
The way it always has. And the change in salinity of the water as a result of that has been on the order of thousandths of parts per thousand. So very, very little change in the amount of water itself. And it would take a much, much larger amount to actually do an effect, to actually slow it down in the area what they call the sinking zone of the of the belt.
Okay.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but the Gulf Stream has actually been getting warmer.
Well, it striates. That's the problem, right? We have this energy-rich and energy-not-rich pieces of the stream, the Gulf Stream. And if you mix it well, then you can redistribute that energy. But when the energy intensifies because you get that stratification or striation, that's where you're going to have these zones of lots of intensity, lots of hurricane kind of generating weather. When you shake the snow globe and make everything distribute, that actually is that could lead to global cooling, actually, because you get then you're going to distribute that heat more over a much larger surface.
Number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum on WAMC Vox Pop, and Dave is in Burnt Hills. Dave.
Hey, I'm responding to the question about Bill Gates' investment in nuclear.
Okay.
One of the companies he's investing in is called TerraPower. And if you go out to TerraPower's website and look, there's a reactor called the Traveling Wave Reactor. And the issue about sodium versus water, it's really not an issue. They've come through that. But this is a profound new technology they're investigating, whereby they use all of the nuclear fuel, 100% of it, and it's not pre-processed. They take it out of the ground, they put it in the reactor, and they use it, and they use it all. So there's no nuclear waste. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Anybody here on the panel hear of that one before?
Nope.
Okay, we'll have to make that one for homework, Dave, and we'll maybe bring that up on the next one. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Paul in Albany. Paul.
Hey, is that me?
Yeah, that's you.
Okay. So I heard there's another car come barreling out of the depths of space. Apparently, I guess it must be related to our solar system and whatnot, but we just never see it because it only comes like every 2.5 million or 3 million years or something. And they say it might pass the Earth very close. Is there any chance of hitting the Earth?
Mm. Well, they have hit the Earth in the past, but what you're talking about is what's called an Oort cloud comet, and unless it changes its course radically, it shouldn't come very close. If you want to follow these things, you can go to a website called spaceweather.com, and it actually gives a list of all the asteroids, comets, and other things that are coming towards us and how close they're going to get. Mm. If you're really worried about it, that's the place to go.
Yeah, my understanding was that this one's going to stay pretty far away. I'm not even sure we'd be able to see it visually.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to be all right, Paul.
That's good.
I'm gonna pay my mortgage for next month.
All right, fair enough. I mean, when the next one comes, then we're in trouble. But, Paul, thank you. 800-348-2551. Rhonda in Sheffield. Rhonda, you're on.
Hi. I saw the most amazing bug yesterday.
Really?
And it was a praying mantis,
yeah.
Although the only praying mantis I've ever seen before are maybe 3 to 4 inches long, maybe, no, 3 inches long, pale green. This one had to be 6 inches long. It had a dark underbelly and a tan color. And the most remarkable thing about watching this bug was it had landed on a pot of flowers, and it was sitting there, and a truck went by on the street, and the thing swiveled its triangular head to watch
cool. The
truck go down. And then my husband said something, and it swiveled its head back over. I've never seen or interacted, had seen a response in an insect like that.
Oh, I wish I had students like that.
That is so cool. Rhonda, we saw one at our house on Saturday, and I'm not sure it was quite that big, but it was a biggie. It just sat on our hedges in the front of our house. I took some pictures of it, and really, I mean, those things are amazing. But every time I see one, I think about that movie, The Deadly Mantis, where the thing was huge, and it was in the Holland Tunnel. Do you remember the movie?
Yeah. I knew you couldn't help but think that. But to see it turn its head when it heard a sound, it was neat.
It may even have been a vibration more than the sound, even though it was your husband's voice. Like sometimes, you know how we don't hear our husbands, but we can still sense their presence.
Yeah, it could be.
You know what? That's a shot.
So,
sorry, honey.
Rhonda, thank you very much for the call. You want to add anything to that?
No, just wanted to share that. I really enjoyed the show. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. The Science Forum today with Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, Roger Jaboni, and Barbara Brabets, and looks like Randall in Ellington, Connecticut. Randall, you're on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, guys. Yeah, I was watching a documentary about a week ago stating that if the United States got rid of all CO2 emissions, it would only amount to 13 to 17% of the total worldwide, and that 70% of the CO2 emissions is jet aircraft. I'll take the call and answer whether it's is correct.
Okay.
And I'm going to hang up.
Gotcha,
Randall. Answer.
Guys, is that correct?
Last time I knew, and I haven't looked since the pandemic, but that CO2 emissions that we put out versus the rest of the world, we're about 20 to 25% of the putting out. Per capita, for every person, we are by far the largest CO2 producer per person. The next largest nations are China and India, and they obviously have populations that are far greater than ours. As far as jet aircraft, that's only a portion. You can actually do the calculation with a simple hand calculator. It is only a small fraction of the amount of fossil fuel that's combusted every year. So I doubt it would even be 7% of the CO2, let alone the 70% that you read.
And the other source of CO2 that isn't talked about, of course, is volcanic activity. And that makes up about 10% of all the CO2 in the atmosphere.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. The Science Forum is in action today. Ramon in Rome, Massachusetts. Ramon, you're on.
Thank you. We have a lot of dirt roads that I drive on, and when it gets rainy and a lot of downpours, some of the dirt roads develop what we call a washboard effect.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm just curious, if it's part of the water washing down the top of the road, why is that washboard effect always perpendicular to the road of travel? You would think that if the water was having an effect on the dirt road, it would be going to the sides and rivulet, but it's always perpendicular to the road of travel, and I was always curious why it happens.
Right. Well, basically, when you're driving along in a car, if you hit a bump, it causes the car tire to bump upwards, and then it comes down afterwards. And so as you're moving forward, you take one bump, and it turns into two bumps. And then the next person that comes along gets hit by the first bump and the second bump, and it gets the car developing a pattern to make the third bump. So the washboard patterns in roads, these bumps that form, are usually simply caused by the first bump being introduced and then the rest of them.
So no vehicles, no continued bumps.
No continued washboard.
They had it, though, even with stagecoaches and such, because they had the same problem. Of course, they didn't have shock absorbers the way we did, but they had springs, and so those leaf springs would do the same thing.
Yeah, you're talking about an oscillation.
Right. Yeah.
But I got to tell you, we have a camp in the Adirondacks, and we go in on a logging road, which never hasn't been logged in 100 years. It's very rural, very. And when we get the heavy washouts of the snow, it goes down to what they call the corduroy, and they're perpendicular to the road.
Right.
And there's no vehicles traveling that road.
But is the corduroy old lumber that was put there for the logging road?
No, it's not. It's the pattern in the hardscape. Mm-hmm. There's a pattern in it. And they call it corduroy up there. But
it was probably generated that way.
It may be.
And the reason it happens when it after the rains, when it's wet, is that softens the road. I grew up on a country gravel road, too.
And so you know it all too well.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Ramon, thanks for the call. We go now to Mame in Rensselaerville. Mame, you're on.
Hi there. I'm calling about a little piece, a blurb that I saw, I think it was in the Huffington Post, about the detection of radio waves that are coming from somewhere inside the galaxy, and they don't really know where they're coming from or what they are. Did any of you read about that?
Are these the fast radio bursts that we're talking about here?
They didn't go into the details.
I don't know then.
But it seems like a recent a recent phenomena, like in the last day or so?
Well, there's lots of things that generate radio waves all the time.
Yeah.
I'll let the astronomer.
Well, you energy coming out of black holes, for example, or not actually coming out of black holes, but as a star rips itself up going in towards a black hole, it starts producing a gravitational effect and also a magnetic effect, which sends waves out into space. And these can be picked up. They're called pulsars. It's one form of radio wave that can come out of space. They come out of all sorts of things. There's things, gamma ray bursters, for example, which produce frequency all the way through the spectrum. They produce so much energy, and so we get radio wave from those. So there's all sorts of sources for it. I don't know this particular one.
All right. Well, I tell you what, Mame, we are having an astronomy show, and I'm my head is spinning because I'm scheduling so far in advance, but I think it's next week. I'm not sure, but it's coming up soon. In the next couple of weeks, we will have Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman on, and maybe by then there'll be more out there about this. So we invite you to call back, and maybe we'll have an answer for you. Let's go to Susan in Hinsdale. Susan, you're on.
Oh, God. Thank God you got me in, Ray. You read my comments first.
Oh, your email. Oh, yeah,
one.
Yeah,
listen, I don't think these guys are very clear with me here.
Oh, boy.
What I'm talking about is the aging power of UVA and the burning power of UVB. When you walk early in the morning, you're not getting much UVB. Are you getting the standard amount of UVA?
Yes. Yes. The UVA will track the visible light pretty closely. So whatever the intensity is that your eyes are seeing, you're seeing a proportionate amount of UVA.
Right. UVB is kind of like minimal at the end of the day, and it's really strong in the middle of the day. It only goes above UVA at like from 12 to 1210.
Well, that graph was not realistic. What my rule of thumb is that if the angle of the sun is more than 45 degrees, then there is enough UVB in the sunlight to cause sunburn over time. So if your shadow...
Right, I'm not worried about sunburn. I'm worried about UVA aging.
Oh, okay. Wow. Well, UVA,
so
then you need
the
a broad... Then you need a broad spectrum sunscreen.
Right. Yeah.
That'll absorb the UVA.
Yeah, no, I wear sunscreen. Yeah. I wear sunscreen now.
I mean,
okay, but I didn't know it.
You sound fairly youthful, Susan. I think you're going to be okay. Hey, you know, let me ask you a question, Susan, while you're here and while we're wrapping up the show. You sent a very detailed email, and you sent graphs, and we passed them around. If you were just going to call, I mean, you just could have done that, right?
No. I only called because I heard the beginning of the show, and I was like, I'm not really sure they're understanding my question.
They didn't meet your standards, and I understand, Susan.
We failed.
We're out of time. I appreciate.
We'll have to come back
and come back
her next time.
Susan is going to come back and take care of all of us. We appreciate you all being here. Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, midterms coming up, right?
Midterms are up here, yep.
No, that's exciting, and I hope you guys are as
We're up on it.
You're as relaxed and as in great moods the next time we do this. Jim Pickett, what are you up to?
Just hanging around mostly.
You're my idol.
Actually, it's kind of exciting.
I got some grading for you, Jim.
In my consulting job, what I was originally hired to do 7 years ago, we're finally getting around to doing.
Ah, God bless you. Hey, Roger Jaboni, how are things over at Rogers High Fidelity?
Very nice.
Yeah?
Very good.
All right, what's that website, man?
RogersHighFidelity.com.
Support for WAMC comes from Ambrose Electric Standby Power, an electrical contractor providing sales service at installation of residential and commercial Generac automatic standby generators, serving the Greater Capital District for over 40 years. AmbroseLEC.com. At Gardner Supply at Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts, locally owned and operated for over 51 years, offering indoor and outdoor plants, gardening supplies, bird feeders at bird seed, organic fertilizer, and advice, gardeners.com. Once again, thanks to Roger, Ed, Barbara, Jim for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. Tomorrow, it's a Food Friday. We talk flour. It's flour power with Grain Ambassador Amy Halloran tomorrow at 2 p.m. What could go wrong? Stand by for something.